You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Hi, everyone. I'm Hillary Kerr, and this is Life Lessons, a podcast spotlighting women who have incredible careers within a single field or industry. We talk about everything from how they got their start to the best things they've learned along the way. Today, I am so excited to welcome the co-head writer of Jimmy Kimmel Live in the studio with me, the one and only Molly McNierney. Not only is she one of the funniest and best humans I know, she's also a true force in the late night TV show world, having worked for Jimmy Kimmel Live for 16 years, moving up from an assistant to running the entire writing team. I'm so excited to sit down with her to talk about work and everything she's learned along the way. Now on Life Lessons, it's Molly McNierney. So Molly, we like to start at the beginning on this podcast. So what did you study in school and what did you think you were going to be when you grew up?
When I was very little, I thought I was going to be a veterinarian. And then my mom told me that would require that I put dogs to sleep. And then I quickly changed courses.
What a dream crusher.
Right? She was good at that. I was a journalism major, went to University of Kansas, and I wanted to be, more than anything, a news anchor.
Really?
And I would walk around my house with a paper towel roll and talk into it like a microphone and report on the news stories around the neighborhood to an old camcorder my brother would carry around the house. And that was my dream, to be a news anchor. And in college, so I went and studied broadcast journalism. That first year, the first summer after college, I went and visited the local news station in St. Louis. And I shadowed this woman who had the dream job for me. And I was so inspired. I couldn't believe it. I got to watch her go do her thing and go to location, and she'd report. And I got to go in the truck with her. And I thought, this is it. This is all I've ever wanted. And at the end of the day, she pulled me aside and she said, "You don't want to do this." And I was shocked. I said, "What do you mean I don't want to do this? This is the dream." She said, "No, kid, if you want to spend the rest of your life reading off a cue card and having other people tell you what to say and do, this is what you want, but you don't want that, I can tell. You want better than this." And from that moment, I changed my major, which is crazy that this one woman had this complete influence over me, but I'm a very naive and vulnerable person. Like, I get a lot of bad haircuts because I'll just go in and say, "Whatever you think." And then I walk out with bangs I didn't want. But I trusted this woman and I changed it and I went into advertising instead. And then I don't know why I thought that would be better, but I went into advertising. And the dream was then to work for like Leo Burnett in Chicago and write Coca-Cola ads. I knew I wanted to write when I was a little girl. Again, a story where another woman told me something and I just took her word for it. Fourth grade, Mrs. Cooper told me, "You're a great writer." I believed her. And I think it's so important now that I have my own daughter just to tell children, when you see something, tell them you're good at this and they'll believe you. And so I knew I wanted to write, but I thought I'd just be writing copy. So that's where I started in advertising. I worked at a bunch of advertising agencies. I started working in ad sales right out of college.
Okay, so what was that? What's the difference between ad sales and what you thought you were going to do?
It's a lot worse. I thought, I wanted to do something creative. One of the easiest entry-level jobs I found out of college was ad sales, which is not at all what I should have been doing. But the schedule was great. You work like 4 hours a day. You take people to concerts and manicures and pedicures and dinners, and you have a charge account, and you make a lot of money. But I was not at all fulfilled creatively. I was selling the advertising. I wanted to be writing those ads. So I never got into that spot But this job transferred me out to Los Angeles. So I was doing ad sales out here.
Was it for a news company or
for
a magazine?
Interscope Records. Yeah.
I had no idea Interscope had an ad sales team.
Yeah, well, I was selling ads for their webs. Like, they had this website, artistdirect.com, which they were trying to compete with, like, MTV and Napster and all this stuff. And
that turned out well.
Yeah, great. Exactly. Oh, and by the way, this was right during the internet boom and then crash. Mm-hmm. And so I was doing that, moved out to Los Angeles with the company to do that. And when I was out here, I thought, all right, I have got to get into television somehow. I want to be writing for television. And a woman I know knew of a job opening at Jimmy Kimmel Live to be the assistant to the executive producer. And I stayed up the night before, this is before TiVo, trying to watch Jimmy Kimmel Live. I'd never heard of Jimmy Kimmel. I'd never heard of Jimmy Kimmel Live. I fell asleep on my couch before the show started. I woke up during the credits and had a job interview the next day where I had to pretend like I knew what the heck the show was about.
Did you have a relationship with late night TV at that point in time? Why?
I love Johnny Carson as a kid. I can tell you May 22nd was his final show. It was my same night as my eighth grade graduation. And I raced home to watch his final show, skipping the party, going to the party late because I loved late night television. I had no idea that there were writers doing that, though.
You thought he was just saying things.
Which, by the way, is still the way my mom thinks Jimmy does the show. She'll ask me all the time. She'll say, so did Matt Damon know that Jimmy was going to do that? I'm like, yes, Mom, everything is written. Everything we do is written. And as a child, I never knew that.
Why would you?
Yeah. So I just thought it was such a, and I love Saturday Night Live. I loved all the live variety writing late night shows. And I got this job opportunity to be the executive producer's assistant. Not my dream job, but a way in the door.
So is that job sort of a little bit like the equivalent of getting into ad sales right out, like where you might not necessarily need a ton of experience, but it's for someone who's hungry and can do something with it?
Yes.
And then also, what does that job really entail for the people out there? Because it sounds glamorous.
Oh, yeah, it sure does. It's not. It's a lot of grunt work, getting coffee, making sure he has the right organic yogurt in his mini fridge, planning his three-year-old daughter's birthday party, making sure there's a car seat and a rental cars for his daughter, keeping his schedule, keeping meetings. It's very tedious. It's not at all creative, but it is definitely a way in. And I try to tell people currently at the show who have just come out of college and they've got big dreams, and now I'm asking them to get coffee, just do it the best. That's my advice. Like, you might not be in your dream job for a few years, but if you are the best at getting coffee and the best at getting the car seat, and people do notice. I notice at our own show, the PAs who are trying stand out. Everyone thinks they're better than their job right out of college. No question. I remember having those moments coming home. Why did I go to college? I'm getting coffee. You know, what am I doing with my life? You know, I'm 24 and I don't know what I'm doing. Welcome. No one does. It's okay. You can be 34 and not know what you're doing. But just to be in a good environment with people who are smart and creative and inspiring is enough. And if you just stick with your job and keep doing what you're supposed to be doing, you will stand out.
I also think it's one of those things that people don't really understand, that if I can't trust you with the small stuff, how can I trust you with the big stuff?
Exactly.
And it's like all of those small, the minutiae, the details, like that is showing me that you have a grasp of details, which you need to have at any level of your career. You know, are you resourceful? Can you follow through on something? Can you actually execute?
Yep.
Do I have to remind you a million times?
Completely.
Like, and really your job is to help your boss be as efficient at their job as possible, so that because their time shouldn't be spent worrying about, you know, where the car seat is.
Right.
If they should be thinking about work, and if that's something that they can outsource and that's clear in your job description that personal stuff will be a part of it,
yes,
then I think that's just part of the territory.
Completely. Just being able to anticipate the needs of another human being is 70% of these lower level jobs, but if you can master that, it's noticed, and then people want to help you move up.
And it's also setting you up for knowing how to manage up.
Yep.
I think everyone thinks about management as how you treat the people below you on your team, but everyone has a boss.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone, whether it's even a CEO has a boss, and that's the board. So you always have to know how to be how to manage your boss too.
Yes.
And that's sort of your formative training in that. So how did the interview go?
Oh, I wouldn't say great.
You got the job.
Yeah, I did. I was lucky because this woman, Naomi Scott, who is a wonderful woman, she worked there. I was replacing her, and I went in with her, and she was doing all the pre-interviewing before I got to the executive producer, and she and I connected immediately, and we had a great interview. And then she recommended me. I went in. The interview wasn't great. I remember my boss was like slurping on soup the whole time, barely made eye contact, and asked me a question about a topical news story that was in the news that morning. And I faked it like I knew what he was talking about and had no idea what he was talking about. But that's where my improv skills came in. I trained at Second City in college and after, and I did a lot of improv shows. And I think, honestly, improv helps a lot in this world where you just kind of go with it and yes and whatever the heck people are talking about. And he was talking about that scandal in the New York Times. Remember that guy was writing those fake stories of things that didn't exist? And he asked my take on it. And my answer was, yeah, that was scandalous, don't you think? And he said, yeah. And then he just started, everyone loves to hear themselves talk. And so he just kind of took it away. And I just sat there shaking. Anyway, interview didn't go great. But this woman, Naomi, said, I know her interview didn't go great, but she's the one you want. Thank God. So I got this job, which is so funny that I was so grateful for a job that was paying me half of what I was already making.
Mm-hmm.
And I was working three times the hours I was working. I was working from 8 a.m. to 11 p.m. This is back when the show was actually live. 8 a.m. to 11 p.m. I lived in Hermosa Beach. The job was in Hollywood. It was my whole existence. And I was getting paid, when you really broke it down, probably like $7 an hour or something. I was making nothing. Yeah, if. I was making nothing. But I loved being in that world. And I immediately discovered that I wanted to be in the writer's room. Early on, I just watched those guys in awe, and I knew I wanted to be in there.
Well, I feel like in between the improv background, the journalism love, the desire for creativity, the desire to do slogans, and
mm-hmm.
all of that was pointing you in that direction. So what were some of the responsibilities that you got the hang of right away, and what took a little bit longer for you to master?
I have excellent people skills. So I was good on the phone and managing people, and there was a lot of stress in that environment and kind of keeping things cool and calm. I wasn't great at the things like anticipating needs at first. I would set up meetings and schedules and not think of things like, is that paper he needs there? And is the car seat in the car for his child? I would kind of let him get to that situation and call me angry and say, oh, what the hell, this thing wasn't here. But I quickly did start to learn that. But I think above all, I just was eager to please.
Yeah.
I never complained. I was always happy to do anything anyone asked me to do. And I've always kind of been that way. And I think, like I said, that stands out for anyone in a work environment as stressful as ours when someone is not complaining, when they're happy to take on more. And I did that. And then I went and met with the head writer a few months into the assistant work. His name was Steve O'Donnell. He came from David Letterman. He's the guy who created the top 10 list. He's a legend. And he was the head writer of Jimmy Kimmel Live at the time. And I went into his office. He was very friendly. And I said, if there's ever an opportunity, any opening in here, anything, I'll do anything in your department. You don't have to pay me. I just want to help. I want to read what you guys are doing. I want to see what you're doing. And he was very kind. And a few months later, a writer's assistant position opened.
So did your boss know that you were already angling for a different job? Was that a conversation that you felt comfortable having, or was this something you just pursued on the side?
No, I kind of pursued it on the side, and then he was let go, so that's when I really pursued it. And I thought when he was let go, I would also be let go, but they kept me there because I had kind of proven that I was invested in this place. I had one of the supervising producers at the time, Jason Schrift, kind of took me under his wing, created a position for me. In season 1, 2, 3, and 4, probably, of Jimmy Kimmel Live, any given day, we wouldn't have guests. Like, it would be a Tuesday at 3 o'clock, and we would not have a guest for that show. And it was a scary time to be there. And
wait,
they,
why not?
Because we were new, we were young, we were not doing great. It was, you know,
no
we
one
were
wanted to come
bottom
on.
Of the totem pole. Oh yeah, for sure. Things that, I mean, the fact that we survived those first couple of years and are still on is truly a miracle and really a testament to Jimmy and his work ethic. But we really had a tough few years. So we always had music booked, always. And a lot of times it'd be 3 o'clock. We wouldn't have a second guest at least. And they sent me over to interview the bands. We'd make them the second guest. Like usually they'd just do the music, but we were empty. And they say, okay, this band is interesting enough. And I remember my first week I interviewed Carole King, Slipknot, and 50 Cent. And they would send me over to the Roosevelt Hotel where we would put them up. And I'd walk over with a clipboard and say, hey, I just want to talk to you about, you know, what's going on in your life. And I'd try to pull some stories out of them. And then I'd run back to Jimmy and say, here are the things you should ask Slipknot. Here are the things you should ask Carole King. Here's a good anecdote. Here's a good story. And I'd produce a segment. So I started to kind of become good at segment producing. And the
did you know that's what you were doing?
No, I had no idea what I was doing. I was just talking to people, which really is what, you know, late night is.
But you're getting this experience.
It was an awesome experience. And I could have stayed in that department and probably been happy. And they encouraged me to stay. A couple of the senior level guys there said, yeah, you should do this. Be, you know, keep working your way up and become a segment producer. And segment producers on late night television shows are the ones responsible for doing the research, pre-interviewing the guests, and then doing what I was doing, going to Jimmy and laying it out, saying, here's what you should talk to this guest about tonight. And I wanted to do that. It seemed good, but I still was hungry for
that writing.
Yep.
So segment producers are in a different category mm-hmm. than writers. So
yes.
You made your intentions clear mm-hmm. when it came to writing, which is also quite bold.
Mm-hmm.
And I think impressive that you're super green. You'd only been there for a handful of months, and yet you had the gumption to go and say, this is what I want to do. I think I would be good at it.
I think that's half of it, don't you? Like, just pretending. Because here, the truth is, I'd never written a monologue joke. I'd never written a comedy sketch. But I knew something in me would enjoy it and hopefully be good at it. And so I just kind of set that intention and I just knocked on that guy's door and he was a very friendly, warm person and said, of course, I'd love to help you. And then I got in and I got a writer's assistant position and I was so excited.
So how is being a writer's assistant different from assisting the executive producer?
I'm not doing any personal stuff anymore. I was not all that is out.
No more car seats.
No more car seats. No more trying to find a ferry for a 3-year-old's birthday party. It then became strictly about the writing department, collecting the jokes every day, sending them to Jimmy, getting scripts, making sure they're distributed, sitting in on writers' meetings, which was the most beneficial thing ever. Being able to sit in a room full of very, very funny, creative guys who are yelling out funny jokes and ideas and watching the process of what makes it, what doesn't. That was the most valuable year and a half of my life because I got to sit and learn. I just got to watch. There was no pressure on me to write. I just got to learn from these guys. And then they, after about a year of being a writer's assistant, I said, can I pitch some ideas? And they were so nice. They said, of course, you can pitch. You can pitch one idea a day. And so that's what I started doing, which was smart because there's 14 guys at the table and they're required to pitch like 2 pages of stuff. And, you know, it was almost like a nice thing to do for me, but they don't need all my ideas. They had plenty. And I remember my first pitch was terrible. Some company had just come out with a cell phone for dogs or like a way to communicate with your dog on the collar. And you could talk through a little speaker from a remote location. And so I wrote up what I think the conversation between Paris Hilton and her Chihuahua would sound like. And it was so bad and hacky. And I remember pitching it and it was dead silent. Like no one laughed, no one looked up. And I just thought, oh, I'm terrible at this and I should go back to segment or I should go back to car seats. And I just stuck with it. And I remember one of the guys at work pulled me aside and said, you probably shouldn't do that for a while. And it hurt. I was so embarrassed. I remember just like everything feeling bright red. And I then retreated for about a month and I didn't say a word at that meeting. And then when I built up the confidence again, I came back for more and I started pitching ideas every day and I started getting material on the show every day. And I remember getting like 53 ideas on in a row, like 53 shows in a row had something of mine in it, which is hard to do as a writer.
Yeah.
It's a little easier as a writer's assistant because I just had one idea. You know, it's like I have my one thing. I get to focus my whole morning, all my energy on my one idea. These guys have to come up with a lot more. But I got fit like all these ideas on the show. And then I thought, okay, I think I'm ready to be a writer. Now, keep in mind, I really did not think I was going to be a writer. I really thought it similar to just like think it, believe it. But inside, I thought, oh God, I don't think I can manage the stress. I have to come up with more than one idea a day. These guys are coming up with pages. And then I went and knocked on Jimmy's door with all the confidence. Externally, I probably looked so confident. On the inside, I was dying. But you had
52, 53 ideas in a row.
Right, I did.
That's some confidence.
It did give me some credibility going in there. But I still, the job required so much more than that. But I went in, knocked on his door. They had just hired a writer from outside, a brilliant writer, Jessie Klein. She's incredible. And I remember feeling overlooked. And I thought, I'm here. I'm working. Why didn't I get that job? Well, there are plenty of reasons. I was still a little green. Jessie Klein is seasoned and wonderful and brilliant. And I went and knocked on Jimmy's door with all this confidence and said, hi, you know, I just wanted to talk to you. Do you think maybe I could be a writer here someday? He said, oh, yeah, I think so. He said, I understand that you have to hire other people and everyone offers lots of different things, but if you're not going to make me a writer here, and then I like pulled out all this confidence, said, if you're not going to make me a writer here, I'd like to know soon because I'd like to go write for someone else.
Wow.
And then a few months later.
How did he take it, by the way?
He was really nice. He said, I completely understand. He said, I fully expect you to be a writer here very soon and I want that to happen for you. So let's work on getting stronger, and I'd love to make you a writer here. And then about 6 months later, I became a writer.
You know, it's interesting how this has worked because I really think there's something to the fact that you have to ask for what you want.
Definitely.
And I think that women sometimes, people probably, but I can say with certainty women, think that your boss is just going to intuit what you want or anoint you, like that you're like someone will see you with your head down, working hard, doing the things, and then just come in and say, pluck you out of obscurity and give you this fabulous job.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that happens, but for the most part, it seems like what really works is knowing who you are and what you want and clearly stating that to the people around you so that you're also seasoning the pan for them and getting them in the mindset of like, oh, I know what this person wants. So then when a job does come up, then you're top of mind. You're not just saying it for the first time.
Mm-hmm. Now, you have to advocate for yourself. No one's doing it for you.
Hell no.
They really are. And you again, like, you really like to think that they are. You like to think that every day someone's noticing and like, oh, she's got a few more days left of this and then I'm going to promote her. Like, no, they're not going to unless you specifically ask for it, I feel, at least from my experience. And so it worked for me, but a lot of it was completely fake confidence where I wanted something and then was also very afraid to get it. I remember when my first day being a writer and sitting at home, I woke up so early to come up with ideas and pitches and was just, I remember shaking while typing and just like, oh no, I've sold him on someone that I'm not. I'm not funny. I'm not good enough. He's going to look at this stuff and hate it. I'm going to be back to being a writer's assistant in no time.
But you've basically gotten a master's degree in joke writing for all intents and purposes because you've been there observing for all of this time. I also think that it's important to point out you weren't contributing in the beginning.
Right.
And that's okay.
Yeah.
In fact, that's actually great. I think that sometimes people also feel like they step into a job and that they need to start like contributing from day one. And they're at a certain point in your career, that is true. But I think also in the beginning, it's okay to understand. I talk about all the time when I started at Elle, I didn't contribute anything in our editorial meetings because I didn't think I had any ideas. And I didn't really. Right. Let's be honest. It took me a while to figure out what is a good idea for a magazine, like what is a good story idea. And it was through osmosis and being around it and seeing it crafted all around you that then I started to figure out, oh, I actually do have ideas. I do know how to see a story. And you did that.
Yeah.
And then you had some training and then you know, with your pitching. So you're slowly building into it. And I think the other part that's interesting is by the time you got that writer job, you knew what the job entailed.
Right. That's true.
You'd been sitting front row. Mm-hmm. You saw the level of information that you needed to produce every day. And that leads me to my next question. So you say 2 pages every morning.
Yes.
What does that mean? And how do you come up with it? And what do you do when it's tough? Like, how do you recognize what a good joke is?
It is very tough still. I've been doing it now for 12 to 14 years. And it is still very hard every day. I mean, I did it this morning. And what we basically do is to look at what's going on in the world, to read the news every morning, and try to make it funny. And I think the easiest way to approach it is from a very observational standpoint, to take the pressure off of yourself and think, okay, forget I even have this job and I have to write. If I were having dinner tonight with some of my closest friends, what would we be talking about and what would we be laughing about and what would be my angle to kind of make them laugh about what's going on? Sometimes things are just inherently funny. Other times things are kind of dark and you have to find a way to make them funny. Lately, I feel like it's transitioned into reading the news. It's not funny. It's very hard to accept it, that it's a reality. You don't want to make light of it by laughing at it. It's more of a, let's all collectively look at this, look at how insane this is, and kind of give people a relief with laughter, but also inspire them to be a little more knowledgeable of what's going on.
That's a much harder lift.
Yes, it definitely is. I mean, the writing has definitely changed over the course of the last few years. So our job as writers is to do 2 things every morning, to write jokes and to come up with bit ideas. There are some late night shows have just monologue joke writers and just bit writers. Every writer at our show does both, which is good and bad, I guess. You know, some people, every writer there is stronger at one. You kind of know who the strongest monologue joke writers are and the strongest bit writers, but there's crossover every day. And I think it's good to be able to exercise both muscles. So we have a writer assistant who sends out topics. Like this morning, it was Game of Thrones finale, Bachelorette, some things Donald Trump has done. And we look at the top topics and then write jokes and then try to come up with sketch ideas. And you kind of craft those in a way that will get the attention of Jimmy, that have a very strong angle, a clear beginning, middle, and end. That's not just, hey, we should do a commercial that makes fun of that. Like, what does that commercial look like? What does it sound like? What does it feel like? Who's in it? So you want to have it as crafted as possible. So those are the 2 jobs in terms of technical writing, joke writing, bit writing. And then throughout the day, we are keeping track of everything going on. There is a whole team of people at the show who are just watching TV. They're called TV watchers, TV researchers. They watch TV and they pull clips of things going on. And then Jimmy picks some clips and then we sit around as a group and write jokes to those clips. And then we also, the other part of the job, which is my favorite part of the job, is writing comedy bits for the guests, the celebrity guests on the show. So when we have guests that are interested in doing comedy, we'll kind of hear a heads up before, this person has a few extra hours, they'd love to do a pre-tape, or this person really wants to promote this project, can you help them come up with a funny way to do that? And then we come up with bit ideas for our guests. So that's kind of the 3 main areas of what a late night writer does.
And you said the show used to be taped live?
Yes.
At?
Oh, yeah. We late. Used to shoot 9 to 10 p.m. So it was live for, it was at midnight for the East Coast. 9 to 10.
That's changed.
Oh, yeah. Thanks to Janet Jackson. So after she showed her nipple.
Thanks, Janet, for quality of life.
Honestly, thank you so much. Once the nipple reveal on the Super Bowl, everyone became super paranoid about live television. And they put us on a delay. Well, it was a 5-second delay. Mm-hmm. Not much. And a guest, I think the first week back after the Super Bowl, an F-bomb got through. The censor didn't hit it in time. And ABC said, enough, you guys aren't live anymore. And then moved us like 7 for quality of life. We now have backed it up. So now we shoot at 5 p.m., 5 to 6. So
this whole day, that you just described with three different types of writing mm-hmm. all has to be done, sealed, baked, finalized, on the table by what time?
Everything is pretty much secured and done by around 4:30, but every day starts for the writers around 7 o'clock in the morning. Everyone works from home for the first few hours. We come in around 10. Every single morning, your pitches are due by 8:50 a.m. So you're starting to write around 7 a.m. You write it all. Jimmy picks the stuff. Around 11 o'clock, Jimmy has decided what's going to go in the show. And now your job is to, if you've got a bit on, you go out and you shoot it, you edit it, you cast it, you put the graphics on it, you're picking out wardrobe and props, and then that bit, you do it, and it's brought to him by hopefully like 4 o'clock so he can approve it, and then it goes on air at 5. Sometimes you're doing stuff to the very last minute. It's nuts. I mean, every day is a blank page, and then we have a show that we put on every night. It is an insane grind. The other thing I'll say about writing for late night that I love is that the failures are short-lived. So if you have a bad joke that tanked or a bit that didn't go over great or a day that you didn't get anything on the page, which happens a lot when you have 14 writers, there are plenty of writers every day that got nothing on the show, you know tomorrow I can start over. But also, the successes are short-lived too. You can have a great bit that killed, you feel great about it, you can enjoy it for about 10 minutes, and then you got to start thinking about tomorrow's show.
Unless you've created a franchise.
Right.
So let's talk about that.
Okay.
Should we talk about Mean Tweets?
Yeah, sure.
So how did that come up?
All right. Kelly Oxford, who you know, was yes. at my house.
Who's been a guest on this pod.
Yes, she's wonderful. She was at my house visiting from Canada. She didn't even live here at the time. She was very popular on Twitter. She was sitting at my kitchen table reading all the terrible things people write to her. She found herself to be a polarizing person on Twitter and started reading all these terrible things. My husband, who I should mention now if you don't know, is Jimmy Kimmel, at the time came and sat at the kitchen table and said, oh, I'll make you feel better, and started reading the terrible things people have written about him. And I'm sitting there in the middle of this like ping pong game of horrible things, and I'm observing it, and I thought, oh my gosh, this would be great. How great would it be if everyone could just read these out loud? And my intention was twofold. One was to shine a light on how people are talking to each other and treating each other. It's horrible. We would never go up to someone on the street and say the things you'd say to them online. It's cowardly. I hate it. And I wanted to shine a light on it. But the second thing was I wanted to kind of provide a support group for people to say, look, you think it's bad? Like, Barack Obama gets it. Julia Louis-Dreyfus gets it. Like, the people who are the best at their job are getting it. They're getting torn apart every day, so don't feel so bad. We're all in it together. And I thought it would be a bit of an inspiration for even just kids at home who are dealing with bullying and dealing with hateful people to show that everybody gets it. Not to say that makes it okay or it makes it hurt less, but to feel a little less alone in it. So I pitched the idea the next day. Jimmy accepted it, which is always exciting when you pitch an idea and then you're like, oh, good, it's on the page. And then you have to immediately go, okay, now how am I going to make this happen and make it good? And I started collecting them. I remember the very first one I got was from Will Arnett. He was the guest like that night. And then the next night was David Spade or something. And I pitched it. I said, would you mind reading tweets? And the way it works is then I would go through their Twitter accounts and I'd find all the horrible things. So it's a very tricky position to be put in. You say, can you please do this bit and hear all the horrible things people, real things people have said about you. Are you willing to read them?
That you might not have read.
Exactly.
That you might not be aware of.
You might not be aware that people think you're ugly, you're untalented or whatever. So thankfully we got people on board to do it. And then once the first one aired, people loved it. And then it became much easier to book because people want to be a part of a viral video.
Now, is it ever tricky because there are certain things that people are fine joking about and other things that actually hit a little too close to home? And
yes.
How do you figure out what their sore spots are?
Yeah, usually their publicist will do that for me. I send it to the publicist and the publicist will say, I'll send these three on, these three I won't. But I also have a pretty good sense of there are a lot of horrible tweets that threaten violence or are homophobic or are anti-woman, and I take those out because I do have a point where I think, no, I'm sorry, you don't get to have that
We're not going to normalize
this. Yeah, we're not. And I don't want it to encourage other people to do it.
Got it.
But I do find a pattern in that women are mostly criticized for their looks.
Really?
And men are criticized for their jobs. So it's even like the way they're being criticized is sexist and insane, that women, we focus on the actress, like, you're ugly or your arms are big or you have cankles or all this stupid shit. And then men, it's like, he's a bad actor, he's not funny, and he's not strong. I'm like, and then I get annoyed. I'm like, why are you calling us not funny? Or why are you calling us not strong? But anyway.
Of all your signature bits, which ones are your favorites?
I would say mean tweets. My dream when I started mean tweets was to one day get President Obama to do them, and he did, and that was the highlight of my career. But that, by the way, I took a lot of bad ones out. I gave him the lightest, easiest ones to read because I didn't want to turn him off and have him not do it. And I really loved doing Handsome Men's Club, which was a bit when we got a bunch of guys in a room and Jimmy pretended like he was the president of this Handsome Men's Club. And it was a joy to write. And it was also very challenging because none of those guys were ever in the same room at the same time, and we made it look like they were. So it required a lot of production and graphic work, and it was challenging but really fun.
So every day you have a blank page. How much material do you personally feel the need to create every single day, and how do you know if it's funny?
I think this is such a silly and very basic way to look at things, and it's what I tell our writers, that imagine Jimmy saying it out loud and are people laughing out loud. Because there are a lot of things that are funny on paper, or you read it and you find it amusing, but it's very different to have to stand in front of an audience and say it, and it needs to get that. It needs to get to the gut and make them laugh. And I think the things that I find to be the funniest are the things that surprise me, where there's a setup to a joke and you think it's going one way and then it changes at the end and it kind of shocks you and surprises you.
And almost forces that laugh out of you against your will.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly right. But I don't get to write as much as I'd like to anymore, because now that I'm one of the head writers of the show, I am managing a lot and overseeing a lot. So I get everyone else's scripts, and then I'll do a punch-up on them before they go to Jimmy, and I'm kind of working on other people's work mostly.
But so speaking of that, let's talk about your career and how you've been promoted a whole heck of a lot. So you went from being a writer's assistant to then being a writer.
Yes.
And now you're the co-head writer of the entire show. So tell me about that trajectory and how you knew it was time to move up, and at what point you started stating your intentions that you wanted more.
Okay. So when I was a writer, I was a successful writer. I thought I was doing well and I was getting stuff on. But I also had the skills of a writer's assistant, which helped me become a really good head writer. And that's what I want to tell young people, that those jobs that seem tedious and meaningless and beneath your pay grade, and those are probably possibly helping you become the boss of the boss. Like, it's you're preparing yourself for even a couple stages ahead. Because a writer's assistant helped me become a good writer, but it really helped me become a head writer, because I watched the process of the organization in the room and how it was running and how scripts were coming in and out. And I saw what people were complaining about, because people will complain to a writer's assistant. They're
not
necessarily complaining to the head writer, but they're complaining to me, and I'm hearing what is working and what's not working. And I kind of just digested all of that. And then it just happened that when I was 2 years, 2.5, as a writer, our head writer, Steve O'Donnell, had decided to leave. He wanted to have a little more time in his life, and it kind of made the most sense for this other writer, Gary Greenberg, and I to become co-head writers together. And the reason that I made sense was that I had the kind of the organization and the management. Gary, brilliant writer, could punch up any script and make it great, and we were a good balance to each other. And so we were both solid writers, but I think I also had the organization. And again, got it. So excited, insanely nervous immediately. Like, oh God, have they trusted me with too much again?
How did your peers react to that? Because that's a fast
climb. It was fast. Well, I will say majority of the guys were telling me even a year before I got promoted, you should be head writer someday. You should be head writer someday. They were really nice and really encouraging.
Someday.
Yeah, exactly. When I got that, there were definitely a couple guys who were immediately resentful, and it caused tension in the room for sure. They loved telling me I could be a head writer, but then when it happened, I think what happens in it, when someone gets promoted pretty quickly, people who've been in that same position who don't even necessarily, those guys didn't even necessarily want that job.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what it causes you to do is reflect on, oh, where am I going? What am I doing? I got overlooked. And I definitely think it caused tension with a couple of them. Several of them are very supportive and kind, the ones who are maybe a little more secure in themselves. But I think at the beginning it felt odd for a few, but that quickly went away. And then about a year and a half or 2 years into being head writer, started dating Jimmy, which then became, whoa, that's probably not smart. And that is I would never, ever advise anyone to date their boss, ever, just so you know.
Worked out well for you, though.
Yeah, it worked out well. And Jimmy always said, like, oh, you're
worked out well for him.
Yeah, him too. But I remember overanalyzing it and thinking, like, oh, this is going to ruin everything, because I was terrified. I thought, I've worked this hard, I've come this far, and now I don't want that to be taken away, or I don't want people to think that's why I got where I got. I mean, everyone there knew that wasn't the case, and they watched me work my butt off, but then we started dating, and I thought, oh, this is now has hopefully not muddied things, and I got scared. But then, again, kind of a growing pain for the first couple months of that. It felt funny and then went back to normal. And I think that what made it feel like it didn't really change is that I never changed the way I dealt with the other writers at work. Like, I still will make fun of Jimmy, you know, like, they can trust me. I know so much that I would never tell Jimmy. I know what's going on with people and how they're annoyed by something. And I've kept that trust, and I've compartmentalized my life pretty insanely, where work is work and home is home, and I don't let those intersect.
How do you do that?
One of the keys is driving separate cars to work. I mean, I know that sounds silly, but I treat it like this is, we leave the same place and we drive to the same spot the same time every day. But I need to feel like when we leave home, it's separate. And it is. He works in a separate building. I only see him about 10 minutes a day at work. And when I'm home, we have enough stuff to deal with at home now with two children that that becomes the focus. And I mean, every now and then things will bleed over. Like, if I have an idea that I really love and he doesn't pick it, it's really hard. I'm so used to being rejected. Like, every writer there will tell you at least 90% of what you write every day is rejected. You're writing it and just you might as well throw it in the garbage.
And then does it really go in the trash? Because, like, as a journalist, like, if I have a really great sentence and it doesn't make it into a piece, I can always kind of hold that line for mm-hmm. something else and, like, find another place for it. Do you guys ever do that?
Not really, because our jokes are so topical. Like, if you write a great joke for a topic today, it's gone. I mean, if he doesn't pick it, it's gone. But you can pitch a bit idea that he rejects, and then you can revisit and think, okay, I know I if I have a few more days, I can make this stronger. But you better go quickly if it's based on a topical thing.
Right.
You know? So, yeah.
But if it's more evergreen.
If it's more evergreen, revisit it, fix it. I had pitched Handsome Men's Club a year before he ended up picking it. And then this is what happens. He kind of pitched it like it was his idea.
Uh-huh.
But I know what happened. It was like in the subconscious. Like, that happens a lot in our room. Like, people will
Inception.
Pitch something. Yeah. People will pitch something. It doesn't get picked. And then a few months later, someone's like, I have an idea. It's like, yeah, you do. That was someone else's idea. And it's never intentional. It's just, I think it just kind of seeps in. And then someone figures out a way to make it stronger.
Well, I think that's how ideas work in the fashion world. It happens all the time where, like, two designers will show something very similar. They're not copying. It's just in the zeitgeist.
Right.
It's like, you know, everyone went to the same show at the Met. Like,
totally.
Everyone loved the same album. It affects.
Yeah. It's the same for comedy, too. And now Twitter has really complicated things, because jokes are really kind of science in a way, that you have a topic and there's a limited way kind of to craft that joke on that topic. And people on Twitter will beat you to it. It's really hard for us because now everyone has a voice, everyone has a platform.
And they're going to tell you that you stole their joke.
You stole their joke, which we would never in a million years steal a joke. We have a guy whose sole job is to watch all the other late night shows, transcribe them, and then when he looks at our outline in the morning, he'll tell us, oh, that was done on a different show. That we've killed so much stuff because another show did it or they saw it on. Now with YouTube channels, it becomes so hard. But similar to fashion, comedy is the same, where it is just like there's going to be repetition, unintentional repetition, and it happens all the time.
So you work in a room that's primarily men, right?
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about that? Because I have come up on the opposite side of it from the time I started working at The Gap in high school, from my time at Elle, and then with starting the company, have always been women. I mean, we're like 85% women at mm-hmm. the company. So I'm always curious as to like, what is the flip side of that like? What are the pluses and minuses?
Yeah. Well, when I started at the show, it was all men in the writer's room. When I was a writer's assistant, I was the only woman in the room. Then Jesse Klein was there. Morgan Murphy was there. There were women throughout. There was never more than one in the room. And I don't think that's an intentional thing. I can tell you now as a co-head writer, more men are applying for those jobs. When I read 500 packets for an open spot, I think 40 were from women the first time. That's slowly getting better.
So it's a pipeline issue.
It is a pipeline issue. I mean, I could get into this. Like, I think at a young age, boys are told they're funny. Girls are not necessarily. And I think we see the world as a kid and you don't see a female late night talk show host. You don't hear of women writing for those things. And so you kind of think that's not a reality for you. And we have to change that. Twitter has helped me immensely with that because I've found a lot of great female comedy writers, strong, funny women, and they're easily accessible. I can just DM them. You think you're funny? Do you want to write for late night someday? Our job is now to help find them, pull them out. And there are more and more, obviously, and I think it will shift and change. But it felt funny to me at the beginning. I was definitely very intimidated, but I went to an all-girls Catholic high school, which I think is where I got a lot of my confidence because I was always around women. I was never afraid to raise my hand in front of guys because I never had them around. And so I just kind of never changed that fearlessness, even when then suddenly there were men in the room and I had to pitch in front of them. Yeah, it was scary, but I thought what I had to say was just as important as what they had to say.
And that room would have been scary no matter what the composition was.
Completely. Completely. But our room is changing. There are now 4 women in the room, and we're just going to keep growing it and getting more. But it's interesting. The top tier management leadership of the show is predominantly women, executive producer, co-executive producers, woman who casts the show, woman who books the show. I would say the executive branch is more 85% women. The writer's room is now like 70% men, and we just got to, you know, I think we have to find a medium.
That's pretty amazing, though.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure. Women get stuff done.
Yes, we do.
Yes.
We're great at multitasking.
Yes.
So you also write for special projects.
Mm-hmm.
And by that, I mean the White House Correspondents Association dinner, mm-hmm. the Primetime Emmy Awards, the Oscars. Twice. What is it like writing for those big events and how early do you start working on it? Because I'm assuming, yes, there have to be topical jokes, but you also, like, there are certain beats that you know you're going to hit early enough.
Yes. Oscars, Emmys, White House Correspondents, those all start probably about 6 months in advance.
Wow.
Oscars, the first time, Jimmy didn't learn he was the host till about 2 months before the first time. So that was terrifying. You want to put as much thought into it as you can. So we had to pull that one around quickly. The way to approach those shows, you're dealing with two audiences, the audience in the room and then the audience at home. The audience at home is obviously a lot larger. It's a large, global, international audience. But you also, if you cannot make that room laugh, you're not going to make the people at home laugh. So you're kind of doing specific industry humor to get those people to laugh that then will make the people at home feel like they can laugh. You want to deal with topical stuff. So we were writing jokes day before, day of. But Oscars and Emmys, a lot of it is about the movies that year, the shows that year. And once you hear who's nominated, you can start to craft your jokes based on that.
But you have to do all that research, right?
Yeah.
You have to watch everything.
Oh, yeah. Watch everything. See everything, you know, even just what the topical stories are around every movie and every show, who's in the audience, who's pregnant, who's divorced, you know, you got to know all, you got to know everything. And an average night, we'll gladly put a joke in the show that's at about a 7. The Oscars, every joke has to be a 10. There is no room for error there. There's no risk jokes.
Got it. So what kind of boss are you, Molly?
I hope a nice one, first and foremost. I think I'm welcoming and encouraging. I really try, because of my experience, to look at the people who are, you know, entry-level position and try to see who can work their way up. I try to really be encouraging to our writer's assistants, but also to the writers, because I know that job and I know what a grind it is. I know how exhausting it is. I know the psychological toll it takes to wake up every day, read the news, try to make it funny, and then start all over again the next day. So I try to first and foremost just be comforting and kind. And secondly, try to pull the best out of people. Because we have 14 writers. They're all very different. They all have different writing styles. But our job every day is to write in Jimmy's voice. So we've had plenty of people there who are incredibly funny who aren't quite getting the voice of the show. Mm. So you try to look at someone and say, okay, you're hilarious. All your stuff is funny. But how can I help you tailor it now to fit in the context of this show and this voice? So I try to do that when I can. I think to be a good boss, you have to work a lot harder, because if someone's looking at you with the same job and thinking you're not really pulling your weight, why are they going to listen to you or respect you? So you have to kind of try to be the best at that job, the thing they're doing, plus more. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So of all of your wins that you've experienced, mm-hmm. and also I'm sure there have been some hard moments, what are the biggest highs and the biggest lows? Because I think it's important to talk about the failures too.
Oh, absolutely. I think the lows are when I allow the negativity or the stress of the job to get to me and affect me, you know, because I do think that the world right now and what's going on has taken a psychological toll on our writer's room of studying and watching and seeing what's going on every day. So I would say the lows are the moments where I allow it to take too much of an effect on me. The job coupled with the world. And also just the moments, the times where a week will go by and I didn't feel proud of anything that I wrote and I didn't think anything I did was funny, which happens a lot. And then the highs are, for me, first and foremost, I think the camaraderie we have in a writer's room. I love it so much. I think some of the best moments at the show are things that were not written or scripted or put on air, but the moments in the writer's room where we are laughing together. We're laughing and we know whatever we're laughing at is never going to make it onto the show, but I think it's really important in a high-stress job like that to have those moments of relief and normalcy and like those non-pressured moments. So the highs, first and foremost, the relationships. And secondly, I think giving guests on the show an opportunity to show that they're funny. Because I think there are some people you wouldn't necessarily think are funny, and given the right material and the right sketch to help them shine, I love doing that for people.
That's very generous of you. So we like advice on this podcast. And I would love to know, of everything that you've learned throughout your career, what are some of the biggest life lessons that are great takeaway that maybe apply to other people?
I would say the first is there is no job beneath you. I have had my experience doing things that I thought I was too educated for, or I should be making more money or doing more, and I put all this pressure on myself. But like I said, those small jobs do form you. They create you. They make you a better boss. They make you a better person. And if you can master those and do those well, you won't stay in that spot for long. Someone will either notice you, or you will then gain the confidence to advocate for yourself. Second piece of advice, just for writers, and this is so simple, but it's just to write. It's very easy to say, I'm a writer, and then not write and get frustrated that you're not writing. But you really look at your day and you think, how much are you actually writing? How much are you sitting there and trying to write? And write a bunch of terrible stuff. Get it out of your system. You can write a whole page of jokes And maybe at the end of the day, there's just one that's good. But that one made it to air and it made someone laugh. And then it's in the paper the next day. Are people still reading papers?
Yes.
Okay. And just never give up on writing if you want to write. And you might not, you know, maybe you'll write for someone else. Maybe you'll write for yourself. You'll figure out a voice. But just to never stop that process, because it can feel overwhelming at times and it can feel like it's not good enough or not smart enough or funny enough. But if you just keep doing it, it will improve. It has to. It's like working out. You know, like when I go on vacation and I'm not writing, I come back and I feel rusty 1 week away from it. So if you want to get good at it, you got to keep doing it, even if it's annoying and it's not good.
Last question. So for all of the women out there who listen to this podcast who might want to be writers, they might want to be co-head writers, they want to go into late night, what advice would you give someone who wants to emulate your career?
I would say for right now, one of the best things to do is have a Twitter account and to start crafting good jokes. I think Twitter is an excellent tool and a great way. You're limited, 140 characters. I think it's 280 now, but whatever. You have this finite, this definition, this little space. It's the best way to craft a joke. I truly believe that. And you have this platform that people can start to notice you and see you. I would encourage women, if you want to be a joke writer, be on Twitter writing jokes first. And second is to start writing down your observations and your thoughts. Even if it's just for you right now, write them down, the things that make you laugh, the things that you observe in your family or with your friends or at work or in the car. Write them down, and then over time, you'll start to figure out a way to make those funny and maybe write a sketch. And also just absorb as much, watch as much, read as much, and then start to see what things you like. And then I think that'll start to shape your voice. And it's not copying. It's, you know, being inspired by other people.
It's learning.
Yeah, learning. Exactly.
I love that. Molly, thank you so much.
Thank you.
No, get your ass to work.
All right, I will.
That was the co-head writer of Jimmy Kimmel Live, Molly McNierney. Stay tuned on Wednesdays for more life lessons with incredible women like Molly. If you like today's show, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts or iTunes or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to rate and review us. It only takes a second and it means so much to us. We love seeing you spread the word on social. And now you can share your life lessons with the community by hashtagging Life Lessons Pod on Instagram. I promise we read every single one. We always want to know who you'd like to hear from on the show. So if you have an idea, send in your request the old-fashioned way via email to hello@secondlifepod.com, or you can DM me on Instagram. I'm at Hillary Kerr. The show is at Second Life Pod, whatever you choose. I'm Hillary Kerr, and you've been listening to Life Lessons.